we need to recognize that ISIS has been supported and funded and armed by one of the closest U.S. allies in the region, which is Saudi Arabia. And yet we don't hear this level of criticism, lobbied against the Saudi Arabian government. So, yes, Israel is partly of that, but if we also notice how the word terrorism has been used by the Western press, it's only used when the victim is an individual that has to be humanized and is recognized with their full humanity. And it's discarded completely when the victim has to serve a dehumanizing purpose. Now, the Israelis take it, of course, to the full extreme, where a terrorist has to be an Arab. And if you have a Jewish Israeli that commits a crime, then immediately that act is denoted into simply a bombing or a crime or an attack. In the United States, the word terrorist has been limited to when the accuser happens to be either Muslim or Arab. Just like the word thug happens to be used only when the accuser is African-American, and yet when a European-American commits a crime, then they use the language of, mentally unstable. So we have this discourse that's deeply racist that I would argue goes beyond Israel and the U.S. press and stems from a justification of the crime and a refusal to empathize or to connect with the victim. And this is what we see, and this is what the U.S. press and the BBC continue to do with regards to this region.
All right, Rani Amasri, just before we let you go again, so just to say there was a terrible multiple bombing in Beirut, and you're saying that over 40 people have been killed in the civilian neighborhood. It may include women and children among the dead. It was clearly a civilian bombing near a school. Any final things you want to say to us? We do want to keep in touch, but final words.
Final words. I mean, one, let us not mince our words when we talk about this terrorist attack that has just occurred in Beirut. And let us not forget that this has not been the first ISIS attack against our neighborhoods in Lebanon. It has not been the first. And unfortunately, I doubt that it will be the last. And if anyone in the United States wants to stop these attacks, then let them stop the financial pipeline of support for ISIS, and let them stop supporting all these wars and all these occupations that the U.S. foreign policy has been built on from the very start, and that they're continuing to do, be it the occupation of Iraq or the further destruction of Syria.
All right. Rania, thank you for taking the time out. I know it's very late there, and it is a terrible time again in Beirut. But thanks for taking the time out to be with us on Flashpoints.
You're very welcome.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We are honored to have, one of my heroes in the studio here, Dr. Mads Gilbert. He's the medical director of the Clinic of Emergency Medicine, University Hospital of North Norway, and a professor at the University of Tromsø. That's the Arctic University of Norway. But Dr. Gilbert, who is somebody you've heard on these airwaves, usually during the carrying out of one or another of Israeli slaughters against the Gaza Strip. It's obviously a place where you get to bomb people who don't even have a place to run to. They don't even have the privilege of becoming refugees again because there's nowhere to run. Dr. Gilbert, we welcome you to Flashpoints. Dr. Gilbert has a book about his experience, his most recent experience in terms of the Gaza slaughter. And then, of course, he was there for Operation Cast Lead, right? And there was a book about that as well. You were a witness to these two latest, if you will, overt and huge slaughters, because the killing goes on nonstop in terms of the shooting people who are living on their own land and been occupied for almost ever, it feels like now. Dr. Gilbert, welcome to Flashpoints. Let me ask you, when did you make this decision? What led you to want to be in Gaza during these Israeli slaughters? What brought you there?
Well, I think basically because I feel a duty to side up with the Palestinian people. I think we should all remember the words of Bishop Desmond Tutu, who says that if you, in a situation of oppression, maintain a position of neutrality, you always end on the side of the oppressor. I don't want to be on the side of the occupier. I think that the issue of Palestine, it's not a difficult conflict, as it's called all the time. It is a difficult and unjust occupation that has lasted for 70 years soon. And I think the Palestinian people need all the support they can get to sustain all the injustice. And during the times of Israeli attacks, I am being asked to come by the Palestinian health authorities and by my colleagues in Shifa, not because the Palestinians cannot manage themselves, because there are extremely good health professionals, but because they need solidarity. They need someone to stand by them, of course, as we all need when things are getting really, really bad. And I go there on behalf of my university hospital. I'm sent by my hospital director. I travel to Gaza because I want to be of use. I want to show solidarity in praxis. And I think that actions speak louder than words. That's why I go. I also want to be an objective medical witness to the sharp end of the Israeli military machine. Because our sanitized mainstream media, it has turned into being a lie machine, more or less. And every time I come here to the United States, I love the American people, but I think that the mainstream media here is a big a lie machine, basically. It's not telling the truth, and it is distorting the realities, and it portrays the Palestinian people in a very wrong way, and the struggle for free Palestine in a wrong way. So I think there is such a need for alternative voices and the other narrative, the narrative of the Palestinian people, which I try to tell through the stethoscope, through the medical eye, and through my narrating of the Palestinian experience.
Through the stethoscope, right from your ear to the heart of the matter. Well, let me ask you, you were in Al-Shifa Hospital at the height of the last bombing in 2014. Paint us a thorough picture of what that was like. What we heard constantly from the Israelis is that they were bending over backwards to avoid civilian casualties.
Well, let's look at the numbers from the last UN report. The commission that was established by the UN to investigate the last attack. If the Israelis, on the one hand, say that 90% of their bombs hit the intended target, which they say all the time, they have the most modern precision weapons of all time, which they have developed together with the U.S. military machinery. And at the same time, they are actually killing 5 civilians for every Palestinian fighter that they kill. They killed altogether 2,251 people. Of them, 551 were children.
551?
551 were Palestinian children. And 299 were Palestinian women. So how on earth can you claim that you try to avoid civilian casualties when you kill 500 children in 51 days? Now, one Israeli child was killed. That is one Israeli child too much. No Israeli children should get killed. Civilians should not be attacked. I condemn any Palestinian attack on civilians, as I do with Israeli attacks on civilians. But there is absolutely no question of the disproportionality between the attacks from the Israeli army on the Palestinian people in Gaza and the meager attempts from the Palestinian people to defend their people, the militants. How can you say that you bend over to protect the civilians when more than 50% of the Palestinian hospitals were damaged from the, you know, breaking of glass and falling down on the ceilings to complete demolishment, like the rehabilitation hospital, the Wafa hospital in northern Gaza? How can you say that you protect the civilians when 60% of the primary health care centers were destroyed and many of them had to close? How can you say that you protect the civilians when 47 ambulances were more or less destroyed? How can you say that you protect the civilians when more than 100 healthcare workers were killed or injured? These numbers all from the UN report. There is no doubt in my mind, and I've seen this, that the Israeli attack during the last assault on Gaza was directed at the civilian population as well as against the Palestinians trying to defend their people. More than 140 families had three or more family members killed in the same attack. It was as if the Israeli army was trying to eradicate the DNA of the Palestinian resistance. It was just horrible. And in particular, the slaughter of the people in Sashaya on the 20th of July, and the siege and the bombardment and the slaughter of the people in Qusar in southern Gaza. These amount to massive war crimes.
I need to ask you to step back. I want you to unpack when you're not, I assume this is not hyperbole, you're calling it a slaughter. Say a little bit more about what you mean by that. You've seen an awful lot, Doctor.
Well, I mean by that when you pound a civilian neighborhood with tons of high explosive artillery shells and 1-ton aerial bombs, and you know this is one of the most densely populated places on earth, you know you're bound to kill civilians, old women, children, civilian men, whoever lives there. They cannot escape. There are no shelters in Gaza. There is no safe haven in Gaza. There is no way to get out of Gaza because of the siege. So when I say slaughter, I actually base it on the conclusion that American military experts from Pentagon had when they analyzed the arsenal used by the Israeli army against Sashaya. They said that this use of arms and military force was meaningless from a military point of view, and it could only have one aim. It was to kill as many people as possible. You know, the Israelis used the term, we're moving the lawn. When they attack Gaza, they're sort
mowing
of
the lawn.
Yeah, they're kind of trimming, and they do it every second year. It's an awful expression by itself. The American military experts concluded with the attack on Sashaya, they're not mowing the lawn; they're removing the topsoil because of the brutality. According to the UN report, the Israeli army dropped or shot 522% more weapons against Gaza during the last attack compared with Castled in 2009. And we thought Castled was bad. Now, the last attack was 500% more arsenal of weapons dropped and shot at the people of Gaza. And of course, what can you say? It is a slaughter. We saw it. We saw the kids. We saw, I received families of four with children without heads, with heads shot half off, all killed. And I have no other word for it than a slaughter of the civilians. They dropped leaflets to say they should escape. Where should they go? They did their knock on roof with the drone rockets saying, leave this house because we're going to bomb them. Where should they go? Out in the streets where the artillery shells were exploding?
So to be clear, what they would do is they would call it they would knock on the roof with a smaller bomb. That was like a minute or two warning, and then that was the time they were given to leave, and the bombs began to fall again.
And then the 1-ton bomb came and took down the whole house. And they, you know, it's almost impossible to describe this hardest feeling, this feeling of being in hell when you are exposed to the Israeli rage, the military machine, which is so powerful, and it's so small a territory that they're bombing, that it is unavoidable with this huge civilian losses. 70% of the killed on the Palestinian side, at least, were civilians. Like in 2009, like in 2012, like in 2006. And I have been working at Shifa Hospital during all the last four Israeli attacks on Gaza. And it's been a mounting brutality. It's been a sharp increase of the amount of shells, bombs, and the types of weapons used.
Dr. Gilbert, let me ask you a little bit more about that. Let's talk about the kinds of wounds you were treating. We heard a lot about the use of new weaponry, advanced weaponry, unconventional weaponry. We heard this notion of the dime bombs that sort of shred people from the inside out. Could you talk about the wounds specific to this war and some of what you saw there, trying to save as many lives as you could?
Well, first of all, let me underline that I am not the one saving lives. It's the Palestinian doctors, nurses, paramedics, and volunteers, the medical students. They are the heroes. I am by no means a hero. I just do the little I can do to be a decent person. The wounds we saw were much more shrapnel wounds this time because the character of the attacks, it was a ground invasion. They shot a massive amount of artillery shells against these residential areas. Less of the type of dime weapons that we saw in 2009, much more shrapnel injuries, you know, this multiple punctuation of the skin, where these small metal fragments from the casings of an artillery grenade, which has a very heavy specific weight, made to cause maximum injury. These metal castings, they disintegrate in a swarm of shrapnels that travel at very high speed. And you know, the energy is half the mass times the velocity in the second power. So the higher the speed, the higher the weight, the greater the energy to destroy. It cuts through your clothes, it cuts through your skin, your subcutaneous fat, through your muscles, and into the body cavities, the brain, the skull cavity, the chest cavity, the abdominal cavity. And in there, these fragments will continue to move until they have delivered all their energy, and they cut open blood vessels, organs, and they break bones. So when you are exposed to this swarm of these metal fragments, of course, there is a high risk that you will have many bleedings, many disturbed organs and blood vessels. And you have, of course, terrible pain, but you bleed to death within a limited amount of time, depending on the largeness of the these shrapnels. Also, people came in with limbs cut off, more or less completely, because some of the shrapnels are larger, like a knife, and they can also cut off the extremities. So there was a lot of shrapnel injuries, there was a lot of head injuries, there was a lot of crush injuries from buildings just collapsing from the bombardment. The use of these one-ton air bombs was much more extensive than during the three previous attacks, causing much more almost earthquake-like multi-trauma crush injuries. And of course, children exposed to these heavy weapons were often completely crushed.
You know, Dr. Gilbert, the scientists say that we're made up of atoms, but really we're also made up of stories, and your book is full of stories, and it's the stories that help us keep a human face. So can I ask you to recall some of the specific stories, some of the families or some of the things that came up that, you know, as you say, sort of are burned into the retina and unforgettable?
There are so many I could pick from, unfortunately. But I think the most important story for me is to tell the story about the bravery of the Palestinian healthcare workers. The morning of the Sheshaya massacre, the 23rd of July, we heard screams from the disaster reception area, the emergency room, and an ambulance came wheeling in with Fouad Jaber, a young Palestinian paramedic who had been killed in Sheshaya in his uniform, in his uniformed ambulance, together with a journalist and patients on board. The ambulance, one of the 47 ambulances being targeted by the Israeli army, and all on board were killed. He was married. He had a small girl of 4 years, I think. And of course, it was extremely painful to see this this fighter for justice, this health workers risking his life to save his people, being so mercilessly killed in his uniform on call. And it reminded me of the helplessness you feel when this mighty power disregards international law, disregards the Geneva Convention, and has the world superpower number one, the US, United States of America, to support it continuously. President Obama knew from hour to hour what was going on. They knew the numbers of killed from day to day, from hour to hour. They knew from the satellite pictures what kind of buildings the Israelis were bombing. They bombed 220 schools.
220 schools?
Yes. They bombed half of the hospitals, more or less, destroyed them.
On purpose?
We have to ask Israelis, but you know, they have the coordinates for every single building in Gaza. They know exactly who is living where. They know exactly which phone numbers to call. There is not a centimeter of Gaza that they don't, that they haven't mapped and recorded and know the purpose of the building. So, you know, they know what they're bombing. Another extremely strong story is, of course, when the one of the leading doctors in Shifa Hospital goes home for lunch, and he finds his home bombed, completely destroyed. There was one of the anesthesia technicians in the OR. During the so-called humanitarian ceasefire, when the bombing was stopped for a few hours after the Sheshaya massacre, they could go home to see if they could find their dead ones. He showed me a picture on his phone the same afternoon with a cage with a bird in, and he said that was the only thing he found from his home, which was completely leveled. And I said, why did you go back? And he said, well, I did go back because I thought maybe the bird was alive. So his care and concern for this living creature, the bird, was greater than the concern that the Israeli government and the U.S. government had for the people of Gaza. So there are so many stark contrasts, and I could tell you endless stories about the bravery of the people, which I want to focus, the resilience of the Palestinian people, their humanity in the way they stood together. And they all told me, now, it's not Hamas, it's not Fatah, it's not Ramallah or Gaza. It's us, the Palestinian people, standing together in defiant resilience, in resistance against the occupation. We'd rather die now than to surrender. We want to protect our land. It is our land. We want to live as free people. We have the right, and we want to protect our families. This is the story of Gaza. This is the story of the West Bank. This is the story of the Palestinian refugees in Syria, in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Jordan. It is the biggest moral, political, and ethical challenge of our time that the State of Israel and the colonial project of Zionism is allowed to oppress this people for so many decades, making life so miserable, not only for the Palestinian people, but also for the neighboring people, and at the end of the day, for the Israeli people themselves.
And I just have a minute or two left, but I think I would be remiss to not talk about, to ask you just briefly to talk about the devastation that happens at every level in terms of the amount of drones that are in the air and making war. There is no going home to relax. There is nowhere to hide. Right? When this is going on, it doesn't matter.
No, you hear the drones around the clock. One, two, three, four, you hear the humming. Some of them are surveillance drones. Some of them will carry Hellfire rockets or spike rockets.
You don't know.
You don't know. You don't know. It was one night I was walking because I was going to Marna House where I lived, just across the street from Shifa, to pick up some stuff and to change my clothes. And suddenly I heard the drone above my head, and I thought, you know, they've probably spotted me. I'm all alone in the street. The streets of Gaza were completely deserted because it was so dangerous to be outside. And I got this completely choking feeling of being targeted. And I thought, you know, they're going to hit me now. And the next thought was, of course, to try to imagine what it means to be a Palestinian in Gaza. a child 8 years or older who have in their short lives experienced four brutal attacks on their lives, their neighborhood, their schools, their families. They have been under siege their whole life, not having enough food, not having water enough, no freedom to move around, limited education, no freedom to travel. You know, this is the reality as we are speaking. And it's not a ragtag, uncontrolled, desperate, fanatic guerrilla army. It is the governmental army of Israel. It's the official politics of the state of Israel. It is with the full support and $3 to $5 billion a year from your tax money, which is upholding this merciless medieval siege and repetitious bombing and killing of thousands and thousands of civilian Palestinians. If we don't stand up against this, we will be judged by history. And we have to learn that turning our back to a people that is being oppressed and annihilated is the worst thing we can do. So, good folks listening to this, get your ass moving, be active, join the BDS, organize yourselves, do like the brave activists who blocked the harbor of San Francisco and Oakland to hinder and to stop the unloading of Israeli ships. You know, at the end of the day, this was what brought down South African apartheid. This is what we have, ordinary people. We can stand together, we can say enough is enough, and we can organize ourselves with peaceful means to stop this totally unacceptable, meaningless, and brutal oppression of the Palestinian people.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mads Gilbert. Thank you for your courage, for your work, and I hope we meet again, and it will be in a liberated Palestine. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to the listeners who had the patience to listen to me. Thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, we're going to be visited by our own Francisco Herrero. He's going to be telling us about his run for the mayorship of San Francisco. Stay with us. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are delighted to be joined in the studio by our own Francisco Herrera. And I'm sure many of you have heard that Francisco had a very successful run for the mayor of San Francisco. He had, what did you have, 100,000th of what the current mayor had to run, or did it was is that
oh,
an exaggeration?
In terms of money?
Yeah,
we had basically Miguel Perez, also our campaign coordinator,
Hello.
Campaign manager.
$200.
We had $6,000, right, Miguel?
A $6,000 run.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's what our current mayor probably spends on dinner.
Yes.
but really, Francisco, it was a beautiful thing that you did running for mayor. You ran. Troubadour that you are, put down your guitar and ran for mayor. Why?
Well, because we are facing a disastrous time in terms of city planning, regional planning. We have to really move ahead and wake our citizenry up and say, what kind of San Francisco, what kind of Bay Area do we desire to have? How do we plan for it? How do we vision it? And how do we really work and organize for that? Because basically, we're all target of getting kicked out of here. And the whole, I'm not talking just San Francisco, but the whole Bay Area.
Yes.
So it was sort of the Google bus and the corporate takeover of Mission and the bodies in the streets that finally got to you.
Yeah, it was really the whole city. Attention is paid to the Mission, and rightly so, because we've suffered at least 10,000 people been evicted in the last 3 years. But we found elderly Russian and Chinese families petrified in the Richmond District, Latinos in the Richmond District, petrified. Any minute now they'll get the famous letter saying, sorry to inform you, but you're got 3 days, you got to have 30 days. We found people working with full-time jobs in the Sunset District, living in their cars, 2,700 children. The school district claims are living in their cars or in living rooms. So the whole city is being affected by the third worldization and of the city. And what I mean by that is an administration that is selling the city to the highest bidder and ignoring any kind of rules about height limits, ignoring any kind of rules about...
In terms of buildings,
working aggressively to destroy the zoning rules and change them to bring open... I mean, never mind, you know, even the whole mafia stuff with the FBI investigations and all
that.
Yeah,
he found himself after sort of... taking this high road about shrimp boy, he found himself right in the middle of that one.
That's right. And so, but even that's almost like a small piece it's not minor at all, but it is minor compared to like the level of corruption that has gone on in building permits and all this stuff that is aimed at creating luxury apartments for people who do not live here. Why? Because they plan to bring them here.
Right.
They plan
right.
to
so
make...
So you see these fancy shops being built in the middle of neighborhoods where there's nobody living yet.
Build it and they will, and we will bring them later. And then we also discovered the Bracero program for, you know, pretty well-paid techies who have no dream that
explain
they will...
Explain that. People don't know what you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. Bracero, as you know, Mexican farm workers saved the United States economy during the Second World War. No matter what Donald Trump and all these idiots want to talk about, but the Mexican workers saved the United States economy through a program called the Bracero program, which brought cheap labor that could be dismissed at any moment and was ripped off of many of their wages. And so this techie thing is pretty much the same thing at a bit of a higher wage, yeah. right? 100,000, 110,000, whatever. They bring you to the company store. You are paying $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 for a little apartment building. And so there's still the moment that you're going to get married and or have a family, you know you have to leave the United States. Plus, with the H-2B visas, you have a real Bracero program because they can kick you back to India or wherever they brought you from at any moment with these visas. So you want to organize a union? All right, see you back to South Asia or wherever, right? And so this thing is happening, and it's destroying the very fabric of San Francisco, but the Bay Area as well. And we walked for mayor. Precisely, I use the word walk because we have to organize. It's what we need to do. And I think the fact that we got 27,000 votes just in the number one, never mind, it was 52,000 when you talk about the ranked choice voting, 1, 2, 3, but 27,000 votes, it's not because just people are angry. It's because we put forth a platform and said, look, you guys, we have to work towards building the San Francisco that we love.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Francisco Herrera, who from time to time is a co-host here on the Flashpoints show. We haven't had him on the show because he's been busy running for mayor. And, well, Francisco, we did mention you put your guitar down to run for mayor, but you're holding it in your hand now. And maybe just what was a song you thought of as you ran for mayor?
One of our great volunteers, Dietrich Rapalski, actually wrote a piece. And it's pretty nice. He made a little video. You could find it called Si Se Puede. And I'll do a little background. Miguel has an important piece to say also about where we're headed now with the campaign. Si se puede, si se puede.
Si se puede,
si se puede, si se puede, si se puede. Working people working hard for a living. The new economy is taking, not giving. Flaunting laws and regulations. Turning our home into someone's vacation. Fuego, 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 conflagración. La ciudad y sus problemas, but we are not alone. Si se puede, si se puede, si se puede. That's just a little piece. So I want Miguel to speak a little bit to the issue as well.
Miguel, where do you want to jump in here?
Yeah, well, for us, is the most important thing is how to create a different force, a different political force. We have this political capital now with these 52,000 votes, who, of course, they want something different. So we have the possibility to create now this alternative political force. That's in one way. The other way was media. Media for us was very, very important. Nobody mentioned us.
Maybe that's why you did so well.
Nobody mentioned
us. If they stop mentioning you, it's not going to be nice.
It was like Gotham City. I felt like it was in a Batman movie.
Not Channel Corrupt 2, media. Not Channel 5, not Channel 7. Chronicle, they talk about us without mentioning his name. And
this is another campaign. Right, they got Chronicle, about 2%.
The comical went in interview and endorsed that leave before they even interviewed us.
So the behavior of media was amazing. That media. But the other media, the media who is on internet, the media of the young people, all these pages, alternative pages, like a Mission Local, for instance, with very good writers, very young people, they support us. And I think most of those 52,000 votes, where we get, probably tomorrow we can get a little more because they never end to count the votes. We almost 3 weeks in this. That can show us how that alternative media, how was yeah. effective.
And so you feel confident,
yes.
Miguel, that that this is a running start to possibility of really making inroads.
Yes.
Do you plan to run for mayor again, or are you going to...
Well, no, right now, we've set up this platform, Dennis, as a 12-year plan, as a proposal to the community. We didn't just kind of dream up a little platform thing. We talked with over 300 people. We organized small meetings, big meetings, and we developed a plan that was basically affordability of housing, protection, the production of housing, education that strengthened labor and wages and benefits, and health that also strengthened the work of our working folks, culture and the arts. So those five pieces, I think, with in pushing on local jobs, are things that we're going to continue working on. Accountability of the police, all are things that people are already working on, and this campaign aimed also at supporting those pieces. We had four winning goals. One was the mayor, of course, but secondly was creating a platform that would foment a citywide engagement, because we got a lot of good groups, but they're all working alone on, and we pushed, and I think we
So your candidacy was sort of a unifying force.
We aimed to do that, right? Yeah, and the third win was to support the progressive proposals, particularly I, F, and H, and we won H. And then the fourth winning goal was to set the groundwork for 2016 to get a majority of supervisors that are progressive. And I think the strategy of the 1-2-3 worked also in that direction to help foment that aim. And especially young people were very engaged about the idea of a 12-year plan, and which we're pushing still. And I think people in general felt very good about the 1-2-3, where candidates are not throwing mud at each other while the big corrupt machine gets away with everything they want.
Murder, so, yeah, literally.
Yeah. Yeah, literally. And so we...
I mean, and it's just, you know, it's so obvious that they're forcing the poor and the working class out of the city, and they're making us travel further and further distances to come back and take care of their needs. And in the process, we get shredded.
Yeah, he spent $1.5 million to get 56% of the vote. Come on. He basically, he came in through the bathroom window.
and those folks who gave him that money, they're coming back to collect. Yeah. We're going to keep talking about this, Francisco, and hopefully you're going to come back and...
One of the things that came out of it is we'll be having more talks with the Richmond Progressive Alliance, with other groups. It's time, folks, that we really need to organized. We got real great support from the Peace and Freedom Party. We got all kinds of support from all kinds of groups.
Answer Coalition
and other folks. Really, it's time that we look beyond the regular electoral circus.
Well, it's
politics.
Time I look. Francisco Herrera, Miguel Perez, two good friends of this station, beautiful people. Congratulations on your successful campaign for mayor. Congratulations.
We'll be going to Flashpoint.
15% of the vote, man. Orale.
Who knows what comes next?
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Cable Community Radio. Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, a regional gathering of community-based media makers sharing space and skills to build solidarity on November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus. There will be skill shares, issue-based strategy sessions, regional breakouts and workshops, as well as movie screenings and a keynote presentation, editors of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, November 14th and 15th, on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is currently hiring for two positions. We are hiring a membership director. This is a part-time position, 32 hours per week, $15.11 per hour. We're also hiring a PM News and Public Affairs Director. This is a salary full-time position paying $31,400.